name's Millie Lake. I'm a research assistant for the Brand Responsibility Oral and Digital History Project. Today is November the 4th, about 5 p.m. I'll first ask you if you can state your name and your position for the record, and then if you can just start with telling me a little bit about what your position was during the period. So we're documenting the Nike CGT settlement process in July 2010, and then the process leading up to that. I'm particularly interested in the university's decision to terminate the contract with Nike, or allow the contract to expire. So if you could start with stating your name for the record, and then tell us a little bit about what you were doing in that period, what your position was, and what your involvement was.
My name is Andrew Schwartz. What were the dates exactly that you're interested in?
So, from the time
July 10th, I got the time for termination.
And the Hugger and Business Tech
Contract. So, January 2009?
Yeah.
Okay, so at the beginning of 2009, I was a student organizer with the Student Labor Action Project at the University of Washington chapter, and which was closely related with USAS. So, I was a student activist at that point, and then at some point during 2009, in the spring of 2009, I was appointed by the president to be the ASUW representative to the Advisory Committee on Trademarks and Licensing. So I was one of three student voices on that advisory committee.
Okay, fantastic. And could you tell me a little bit about how the Nike issue, first came to your attention personally, and then,
Well, okay, so prior to my appointment, I had worked in the Student Labor Action Project beginning in January 2008. So I'd known about Nike for a while in several different capacities, all of which were relatively negative, but also dealing with business contracts with the University of Washington. So we had kept a pretty close watch on Nike's operations in relationship to the University of Washington since 2008, primarily through the Workers' Rights Consortium and also through the intermediary of the United Students Against Sweatshops. But in particular with this case, we found out specifically through the Workers' Rights Consortium, their reports. Not in a formal capacity, but just through kind of informal communications between our group and Workers' Rights Consortium, and then formally through one of their first reports in like early January.
And so, just to clarify, was that while you were a member of SLAC, but before you were appointed to
the SLAC? Correct. Yeah. So I think, because that happened in January 19th, I think it's the date, and I was appointed in the mid to late part of spring quarter 2009.
Okay. Did you have any knowledge of ACTOL, the advisory committee for trademarks and licensing, before that? Have you had any negotiations?
Well, my appointment was part of the founding of that iteration, but there have been, to my knowledge, at least three similar committees with similar charges prior to my appointment dealing with other kinds of cases like this. So yes, I had known about it, and I knew about Margaret, and I knew about Kathy, I should also add, in SLAC, knew very well about these committees and knew a lot and had a very strong opinion about them.
Okay, would you be able to share one?
We were very hesitant. A lot of our meetings had to deal a lot with the committee as what we had presumed to be a stalling tactic. There was a spectrum of ideas. I mean, clearly, I found that it would have been worthwhile endeavor, so I sat on it, but there was a lot of uncertainty about those kinds of committees.
Okay. And did that opinion change the process? I mean, if you come back to it, but did that opinion change the negotiation process? Or how did SLAC generally as an association respond to the committee dealing with this?
I would say that primarily those kinds of committees, the fundamental role is to slow the operation down. It's also to kind of officialize it, right? Which has a legitimate place. I think the initial reaction by myself and everyone else was kind of like a begrudging, well, this is the way it's going to have to be. And then over time, we did kind of cultivate a strategy around it, and so we did use it to our to the ends that we could. And I think we were successful in that sense. Partially because of who was on the committee, and then also just because the conditions were right, and we took advantage of those conditions.
So I want to talk more about that, but before I get into that, if you could maybe tell us what some of the key issues of the negotiation process were from your perspective with regard to 1996 violations. If you could summarize.
I'm going to have to recall this now.
I'm sorry.
This might be a little vague.
Yeah.
Actually, I could have brought my materials, but... So there's an issue of union busting, and there was an issue of whether or not how you interpreted the code. So it was clear that there were three issues. There was the union busting, or union organizing intimidation, which was well documented. There was an issue of workers not getting the severance and back pay that they were owed, which was related to the third issue, which was how the discrepancy between how SLAP, USAS, how members of the committee, how Nike, how the university administration were all interpreting the code, and specifically in the clause that deals with how contractors and subcontractors are identified in relationship to the brand. So for myself and for SLAP and for a few other people on the committee, every contractor that was contracted by Nike post a UW agreement was identified as an entity within the brand, and therefore the brand was incumbent on the brand to the belt landed with them. Basically, they were the final say, and they had the final responsibility to ensure that the labor code was maintained and upheld.
Okay. Yes, yeah, so there were a lot of different kind of competing impressions, it seems, at that time over what specific aspects of the code Nike had legal responsibility to ensure that benefits were paid to the workers, that severance was paid to the workers. And there were certain issues surrounding the, as you mentioned, the aspects of the code of conduct and which garments were produced in the
street.
As SLAP, I mean, speaking for SLAP or speaking for yourself, do you, was it your understanding that Nike was in violation?
Absolutely.
Of the code of conduct? Okay.
There's no denial.
And how did you respond to Nike's claim that they were not, that it was a repeating error?
Well, they were lying on the first two cases. And on the second one, they were just willfully ignorant, being willfully dense, and then choosing to interpret in a way that was basically, no, it's my word against yours. And they took this line of, we're choosing not to interpret that way. And it's like, no, they don't get to choose how to interpret it. If I may ask, perhaps you could describe a little bit of what your mission is as the interviewer and your researcher.
Yeah, of course. Sorry, I should have done this at the beginning. We're basically at the moment attempting to document all the positions that we can,
right,
relating to the stakeholders who were involved in this negotiation process. We're particularly interested in the role that the University of Washington and other universities played or could potentially play in the future in reaching these kinds of positive outcomes for workers' rights groups across the world.
Right.
We are particularly interested in which strategies were effective, what different people perceived to be the most effective course of action, why people think that Nike said it came to this agreement in the end. So I'll kind of tease out some of that.
Sure.
And this is an oral and technical history project at the moment, which is going to be archived in the University of Washington libraries. That's a collection. All of these interviews will be collected together.
How many interviews?
We have no idea. We're trying to interview as many people from class as we can, all the members of Axel. We've interviewed President Emma and Phyllis Wise. We're trying to interview Nike, and we're also trying to go down to Europe. We also want to expand the project in the future to incorporate the
Not Nassau, but in Russia.
Okay, so we'll talk maybe a little bit about that at the end as well. and hoping to inform kind of scholarly work on around that topic as well in the political science.
If I may ask, who's the principal research investigator?
At the moment, it's myself and my colleague Anne Greenleaf in our department.
Yeah.
Funding has come from the business project initially, but we're applying for other funds. We're working with the law school, with the political science department, with some of the members of ACTL, though they're currently in part, like, not connected to the collection of records. We've been interviewing them.
Okay. There's no faculty as a principal researcher?
Well, Margaret Levy was responsible for and other members of the actual board were responsible for bringing funds in the first place, but they're separate from.
They're not overseeing it.
No.
Oh, okay. Very cool.
No, it's an independent.
Are you an undergraduate or a graduate?
If we go back to the issues, and we can talk more about that earlier, we'll have other questions. If we go back to the key issues of the negotiation, could you say a little bit about what, from your perspective, what outcome you wanted to see from Nike to leave the University of
Wales
now? Like, what was your...
In the end, I think we got what we wanted.
Okay.
In a very kind of narrow compliance perspective, I think we got what we wanted. I mean, we didn't get, I don't think we, what was the percentage that we got? I don't know, it wasn't 100%.
I'm not sure of the percentage.
They got maybe like 70% of their oath, what they wrote. So,
the media reports have been very varied on what the actual figure was, and we're trying to continue making to understand.
Yeah, so, yeah, I mean, it was symbolic, it was historic, and it was actually, you know, in compliance for the most part. The fact, in compliance to the extent that finally a check was written, whether or not we achieved compliance in the sense that we allowed for like almost 14 months to go by, if not more, 18 months maybe, so it was the final date's July, that's 19 months. So that's not a very good standard of compliance, but I think in terms of actually getting the workers their money, because, you know, people's lives are on the line, I think we did succeed in that sense. But it remains to be seen on a more systemic level how successful it was.
Yeah, on that note, I know Nike, they were very careful in granting the funds, the settlement package, not to assume legal responsibility
for
the wording of that final agreement was intended not to set precedent in that regard.
Nike's a good, they're a smart corporation. I'm almost misspoken, but they're a good corporation. I don't know if there's such a thing. They're intelligent, they're smart, they're clever, and so I'm sure they were very good at wordsmithing it. But the fact that they paid, to my mind, speaks for itself. And in the grand scheme of things, if it were to go to a legal court case, I mean, the legal precedent was set. They were responsible for it. It's clearly written in the contract. And Nike's dismissal of any kind of legal responsibility is, it's just made up. It's totally fallacious.
Okay, and just on the similar track as well, there were various elements to the final package, including the reference for workers, the compensation, and also the health care benefits for actively hiring. Were there any aspects of the package that you were unhappy with, or you sort of wanted to see something else in there?
So you, by package you mean the final deal, like what it was they kind of conceded. Other than the actual factory management conceding the equipment and Nike actually writing the check, what else was in the package?
There was healthcare benefits.
Rehiring.
Oh,
that was part of you're actually obligated to. Okay, I guess I didn't distinguish that from just.
Okay. Paying
out with their so can you repeat the question?
I just
Yeah. And they also did some training, right?
And I believe Nike had offered that part of the package beforehand.
Sure, totally supplemental. Mm-hmm. Totally, entirely supplemental. And it's also kind of, it's rather condescending for them to suggest that that is in somehow like a satisfactory compensation in place of, you know, the paycheck. I don't think any work in the United States would accept that as a satisfactory term.
Right.
And nor should they.
And you talked a little bit about what you wanted to see from Nike. What did you want to see? What role did you want to see the university play in this process? And how?
Yeah.
Maybe you could describe a little bit about what the action that the university took.
Well, I think in general, and I'm going to speak in terms of what I recall of my conversations while still a SLAT member were, and then my own kind of expectations. I think the committee in general was more ready for action than I had anticipated. We actually did achieve something, which was not my expectation, and I don't think that was SLAT's expectation, just because that the history was justification. But we actually did do something. I mean, they actually paid. And we actually recommended to the president, like, a pretty strong recommendation, I thought. To that extent, I would have wanted to see that happen. That being said, I was not pleased at all with, let me rephrase that. That being said, I still think we waited too long. For quite a while, there was this whole, and you might know, if you haven't done the background research yet, you will soon, you'll realize that there are these two monitoring organizations, right, WRC and the FLA. And I mean, the kinds of excuses and just deliberate delays that the FLA would make and then that people on the committee and the administration would make for the FLA, they didn't report at all. In 19 months, I don't recall one report. And if it was not from them being in Honduras. I don't think they ever went to the factories. It was just total lip service, in direct contrast to the WRC, which went down there almost a dozen times. They had several communications, formal, explicit, thorough communications, evidencing invoices, audits, and whatnot. And so that kind of, and I knew that going in, that there was going to be this kind of catering to the FLA, to the Fair Labor Association, making these excuses. I didn't want to see that, and they did see that, and it was kind of hard for us to get around that. That led to some committee members not necessarily outright agreeing with Nike or accepting Nike's stance and saying we choose not to interpret that, but because the FLA made no remarks, it somehow, and I don't quite recall how, but somehow the debate devolved to the WRC's word against Nike's, and who are we going to choose, and you know, what are the arguments to be made for which voice is more legitimate or which voice is more credible. And to me, that seemed ridiculous. I mean, to give equal weight to Nike, to the brand, the contractor, the brand's voice with the monitoring organization, the third party independent monitoring organization, who we pay a membership fee to, to put their voices on equal standing, it was incredible. It seemed totally nonsense to me. I mean, why would you, what's the whole point of a monitoring organization if the corporation is going to have the same level of credibility in this situation? So I didn't want to see that. And I don't think SLAP wanted to see that, but that's what happened. I think we were effective in ultimately pressing beyond that, and you know, the WRC, to their credit, just made it that only, you know, either the willfully ignorant or the unintelligent would realize that Nike was in the wrong here. There's one other thing I wanted to say about it. I can't recall. Oh, I just want to also point out that we're also a membership. We're a dues-paying member to the FLA as well. And so, when I was in staff, one of our main asks was to leave the FLA, because this was not the first time that the FLA did not produce the product that we paid for them, for their services. And so clearly there's, for me, I see there's collusion going on, but in general, I mean, it's just, if you think of the WRC and the FLA as service providers, in the sense that they provide a service of monitoring these brands and verifying their claims, the FLA did nothing. And to that extent, they're not a very good business partner. So I just want to put that out there.
Thank you. Perhaps you could talk a little bit about your role on Axel, and first of all, start with how often you met with them, how often you relationship made them, what meetings were like, and how much input you feel that you gave.
To my recollection, we met once a month, or maybe sometimes twice a month, sometimes once every 2 months. Over the summer, it was less. My role was to represent the student body, and to that extent, I had to negotiate the official politicking of the ASUW administration. But also, I was fully aware that of all the student organizations and student groups around, there was only one organization and one group credible enough to have a voice that deserved representation in that respect. So I saw myself as default SLAP representative as well. Simply because they were the credible voices. They're the credible student voices. To that extent, my contributions were received relatively well. I don't think the urgency with which I tried to deliver my contributions was mutually met. I think clearly there were professors and staff administrators that were interested in dragging it on for as long as they could. But then there were also other professors who, in particular, Professor Prakash was just a real joy to watch. Because this was a professor, a very qualified, highly credible political science professor who was able to talk about the intent of the code when everyone else, for whatever reason, and I'll talk about why I wasn't able to talk about the intent or the spirit of the code in any kind of seemingly legitimate way. I was really glad to see that and to hear that he was able to make those kinds of arguments. Because as a student and as my background as an activist, if I were to say the intent of the code or the spirit of the code, I feel like I probably would have been written off as some kind of idealist, student naivete. So I was really pleased to see that, and I saw an ally in him. I did not appreciate the way that our appointments were dealt with and managed, to the extent that, less for myself because of the way that my appointment happened, but for the SLAP representative. I do recall at the very early on, the SLAP rep, Steph Adler, requested that her appointment be a rotating appointment, or rather be a general SLAP appointment, so that SLAP could elect a representative. And I do recall that the chair vehemently struck that down. For whatever reason, it was unclear to me, but that didn't seem fair. And that has to do with internal SLAP politics in terms of the way they manage their organization, and also just in general, I would like to think that our university is a democratic institution, although more and more I get to thinking otherwise, but that was clearly not an instance in which an otherwise democratic process was made less democratic.
Could you talk a little bit about the process of reaching the unanimous agreement, Professor Emma?
How was
presented to you, and then what happened?
So, if I recall, there were two votes. One of them was like a 3-6, six being in favor, and the other one was unanimous. What was the 3-6? I don't remember. I'll have to get back to you about this. But the unanimous vote was, it was clear. I mean, there wasn't a whole lot of, there were a couple people on the committee that were ex officio, that weren't able to vote. But were otherwise, their presence was very critical in that they were experts in the field to a certain extent. And one of the ex officios was, I think, the main source of the delay. Primarily, I think, just because, these brands and the representatives that represent these brands are, she has to work with them on a daily basis. So, the more that she has the opportunity to work and negotiate, the less her business relationship has to be stressed, which is, to a certain extent, fair. But also, this is a public institution with morals and principles, and to a certain extent, business relationships might have to suffer at the expense of maintaining the principles. But so it was a unanimous vote because the main source of the delay was not able to vote. And I think, following that, my arguments and Professor Pacheco's arguments and Slap's arguments, were met with open ears. It wasn't a hard argument to make. In particular because the FLA and Nike were just making, one of them wasn't making any claim whatsoever, and the other one was just making something that was totally egregious. And a complete, willful ignorance. Or if not ignorance, willful misinterpretation that served their ends entirely, and was clear, they were clearly not doing their due diligence. So, but that, there was an aspect to it as well, which was, I remember what it was. The recommendation was to put them on notice. That was unanimous. The split vote was whether or not we found them in violation. 6 of us found them in violation. 3 of us did. Something like that. Maybe it was 6-4 or 7-3. And for different reasons. One was a very academic reason that only on an intellectual level can I really agree with. And the other one was I just didn't understand. But yeah, so it was unanimous to put them on notice, which is a probationary period, which is just kind of saying, Mr. President, we believe that you need to notify them that things are being reviewed. It's not that threatening of a recommendation, whereas the other one was, we find them violating. That's what I thought.
So were you happy that the action?
No, I mean, I think we should have found them a violation. It was clear to me. I also recall what happened with. Probably another question. Go ahead.
I was just going to ask about Philip Fire.
Yeah.
If you had any opinion.
Yeah, you're talking to person with a unique perspective here. Yeah, I actually submitted some legislation as the ACW representative to the Senate to demand that either Phyllis Wise step down from her position at the university or step down from her position at Nike. To me, they seemed like a total conflict of interest.
Could you say a little bit more about why you found this to be the case?
Two primary reasons. The second one was, one general primary reason, which is that, to me, the integrity of a public institution is in an antagonistic relationship works with corporations. Now, it's not to say that the success of academic research is an antagonism with a corporation, but that the university administration and the processes of managing the university are in antagonist relation with corporations. So, in a general sense, that was my first issue with it. She was our second in command. I mean, if the president, for whatever reason, was not able to deal with this, the provost is the next person to deal with it. And to that extent, the fact that Nike was able to get her to willfully say, I'm not dealing with this anymore, which is a crucial, crucial issue in terms of the principles that are at stake here, in terms of a public institution, a moral institution, Nike had effectively removed their second in command. And that was very troubling for me, to say the least. And third, I guess it was just the basic distrust of recusal. That Nike already has succeeded in getting garnishing for themselves a 10-year exclusivity agreement with Nike, with UW, so that Nike and UW are even made even more synonymous than they already were. And then just to have our top administrator on that executive board, it just seemed like policies, the best policy for either organization was just not going to be met. And I suppose this could get into a more of a conversation about why I think the benefits of what is to be learned between the university and corporation sharing best practices, to me, does not outweigh the cost of losing some of the publicness of our university. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I do. If we can maybe move to talking about what you perceive, and I know we can kind of over-speculate here, but what you perceive the university's role, or the role,
what
of, the role of universities,
okay.
The University of Washington,
yeah.
Other, I know Cornell and Wisconsin were important in the
negotiation
process. What role you perceive the universities have in Nike's finals?
Yeah. Universities as they are the representation of the student and faculty and staff employee will, are the actor that needs to keep brands in line. They need to be determining the terms of condition, not brands. If the question is which entity, the brand of the university, should have the power to define the possibilities of what is acceptable and what is not, I think the university is absolutely that entity and not the brand. So that being said, I'm a proponent of the designated suppliers program, which is basically a policy and a system in which universities as trading blocks are able to guarantee living wages and associational rights for the workers that produce their clothing, and that keep these kinds of really egregious labor human rights violations at bay. Because of the way they grant, it's kind of like a good factory behavior program. So to that extent, I think universities should have even more power than they do now in determining where clothes are made and how they're made and who gets to make them.
And when you say they should have more power, do you mean that they should take more of a stance on this, or that
right.
There should be a fundamental change?
Well, it's a community, yeah.